We continue now where we left off last week, where we saw the adventure of the two prophets who pointed out the Antichrist. They pointed out that the Antichrist is not the Messiah, but he's a deceiver and a destroyer, and the Antichrist will end up putting them to death. He made war against them, he overpowered them, and he killed them. And we continue with the next verse. And their dead bodies will lie in the center of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. So their corpses were thrown in a central street, in the central plaza of the great city, allegorically or spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, the same city that their Lord was crucified. With the term corpse, or ptoma in Greek, being closer to the word carcass, this term shows the fury and the hate of the beast against the two prophets. And the exposition of their dead bodies in the central plaza of the city shows the total humiliation of the prophets, something that will continue for 3.5 days. The result of this ill treatment of the Antichrist towards the two prophets, to kill them and to throw their corpses in the most central point of Jerusalem for 3.5 days, will have some extenuating consequences. And the first one will be that the lax, the lukewarm Christians, those who panic very easily and they are victimized by cowardice, they will lose heart. Cowardice, my friends, is a most terrible sin. I will tell you this ahead of time, and we will talk more about this towards the end of the book of the Revelation. And it will be a while before we reach that last chapter. And I'm certainly not in a hurry. I only hope that we live that long so we can cover the book of the Revelation step by step. God willing, we will see that the cowardly, they shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. He includes the sorcerers and the immoral, but he places the cowardly first to show that cowardice is a very terrible sin. My friends, when I lose my heart and I change my stance towards Christ, that is awful. Let's be very careful about this spirit of cowardice. Let's begin to carry out some small exercises by ourselves. So when we are facing something scary, a certain threat at some point, which will force me to expel my faith, to stay firm and not comply. Now, you may ask, what sort of exercises could I undergo in order to fight against this spirit of cowardice? There are a number of things, many different exercises. For instance, let's say that at the end of our lessons here, something happens, a mistake takes place, and let's say we fell asleep in the back on a chair, and we found ourselves locked with a deadbolt inside the church. We happen to wake up a couple hours later, and we're all alone, locked inside the church. We are cold. What would we do? Would we start crying? I'm sure that there's a number of people who begin to cry. Someone will simply think, oops, I was locked inside. No big deal. And so many other things, so many different circumstances that we need to be ready to face on a daily basis. We need to constantly test ourselves so we are prepared to overcome anything that may be turned against us, so we will not fall victims to cowardice where we stand to lose it all. However, the lax, the cowardly Christians will be shaken. They will lose heart when they see the two prophets being put to death and their bodies thrown in the middle of the city in broad daylight. They will lose heart. And they will deny their faith. Do you know what they'll think? They will think, it's all over. The game is over. The disciples of Christ almost came to this very point. you remember why Thomas leave? Thomas left because he was highly disappointed. How about the other disciples? The Lord said it. It is written that they were all swearing, not only Peter. Lord, I'm with you. With me, Peter? Yes, with you, in prison and even death. It is written, this night I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. As far as Apostle Peter, who was insisting, oh well, before the rooster crows three times, you, Peter, will have denied me. This stood true for the other apostles as well. The same thing will happen to very many Christians at that time. They will see the two prophets dead, and they will lose hope. They will think they lost the game. Look, the two prophets did not accomplish anything. They admire them, they were praising them, they were ready to follow them, but now, since they became the object of the Antichrist's revenge, they gave it all up. This is dreadful. Please pay attention to this, especially the fact that they will come to the point of denying their faith, and they will be many in this category. We see this in Luke 18:8, where the Lord said, nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? In other words, when I come back, will I find the true faith on earth? Asks the Lord. In addition to what we said, many unstable Christians will be scandalized seeing the abandonment of the two prophets by God. Very many were scandalized before when they saw the Messiah, who was claiming that he was the Messiah, and he went on the cross. Didn't they remember, I wonder, Prophet Isaiah and the other prophets, where Isaiah specifically talks about the suffering of the Messiah? Essentially, my friends, do you know what is the cause of this scandal? This scandal is already at work. It is the scandal of history and the scandal of the cross. The message of the gospel is of the cross. This is the scandal which is already at work. And we have three different types of scandals. The first scandal is the scandal of the cross. The second is the scandal of history. And the third is the scandal of monasticism. Three scandals. The scandal of the cross is, how can the Messiah allow people to take him on the cross? Is God abandoning him? The leaders, those responsible for his condemnation, they were saying he saved others, but he cannot save himself. Let him come down from the cross so we can see and believe. They were satisfied, based on this rationale, that Jesus was not the Messiah. These pitiful people, they crucified their Messiah. So some of the Christians in those years, they will see their prophets and they will be thinking, why did God abandon them? People will be seeing the righteous, the saints, inside history, and they will be saying, why does God abandon his saints? If they're pleasing to him, why is God letting these things happen to them? This is the scandal of the cross. The message of the true Christian gospel, my friends, is centered around the cross of Christ. The gospel of comfort and prosperity is not existent, or rather it exists, but it is the gospel of the Antichrist, of the devil. The true gospel is a gospel of martyrdom. Consequently, how many are those who will endure this scandal of the cross? The scandal of history. To answer your question about the scandal of history, this is when we see evil inside history to reign, to triumph, and we don't see the direct intervention of God. We say, where is Christ? Where is God? Why doesn't he intervene? Doesn't God see what's happening? This is the scandal of history. And the scandal of monasticism is that the life of the monk seems very unnatural. According to some, monks do not produce, they're not productive. You know, they are simply passive. They need to be productive, to do things, to offer things to society. Of course, these are people who have no clue what spirituality is all about and what the purpose of life is all about. But I will not expand much more at this point. Obviously, the impious will rejoice exceedingly, as we will see briefly from their actions. The pious and the seasoned Christians, the Christians of the crucifixion spirit of the gospel, they will glorify God for this testimony and martyrdom of the saints of God. They will see these two saints. They see that they gave their testimony. They were martyred and they were put to death. Glory be to our holy God. And they will be awaiting with much consolation, hope, and holy expectation the Lord Jesus Christ from heaven. As you can see, the same event can have altogether different results for different people, for the lukewarm Christians, the persecutors, and the faithful. But what is this great city that will host all these dramatic events? Jerusalem, my friends. Now, you may ask, which Jerusalem? Is it the geographical Jerusalem or some other city named Jerusalem allegorically? And this may not be the real Jerusalem, being that we have other examples of such allegory in this book, namely Babylon the Great, this prostitute which made the nations drunk with the wine of her fornication. Which Babylon? Initially, when the Holy Evangelist was writing the book of the Revelation, the geographical Babylon did not exist. Babylon was destroyed. So the Holy Evangelist was obviously aware that Babylon no longer existed. So this was a metaphorical meaning. He is referring to Rome. He says, she became drunk with the blood of the saints. And historically, this is nothing else but the bloody persecutions against the Christians of that time. But all the anti-godly powers, in a general sense, are named by the term Babylon. So could this not be Jerusalem? It seems, however, that this is the geographical Jerusalem from a number of indicative circumstances. Initially, we have St. Andrew of Caesarea, and this is precisely why I read the opinions of the fathers, and I do this to fully support our teachings. I know the opinions of the church fathers can be tiring for us, but I do this so no one can accuse us of providing our own personal interpretation. God forbid. I don't interpret anything by myself. So St. Andrew of Caesarea writes, and he will abandon their bodies unburied in this Jerusalem, the ancient Jerusalem, the one which has been destroyed, in the same one that the Lord suffered. In other words, in the old Jerusalem, which was destroyed by the Romans. It seems that in this city, the Antichrist will come to give rise to the royal house imitating David the king, there where God's son, Christ, our true God, was born in the flesh, so he, the Antichrist, can convince the Jews that he is fulfilling the prophetic word, I will resurrect the tabernacle of David that has fallen. So how is the Antichrist going to convince the Jews that he is fulfilling the prophecy of David? Simply by settling in Jerusalem. Because he will tell the Jews that I come to fulfill the prophecy, I will resurrect the fallen tabernacle of David, and I will rebuild what is destroyed in it. Now, how is he going to deceive the Jews? Certainly not by doing this in New York City or in Melbourne, Australia, or somewhere in Luxembourg. No, the Antichrist will do this in Jerusalem. And from this, we see that this refers to the ancient Jerusalem, the specific geographical city of Jerusalem. So a metaphor does not apply here. The following reasons point to this direction as well. First, the entire scenery of the vision with the measuring of the temple refers to this city where all these events are unfolding. Second, the description of the city as Sodom and Egypt. It is very important that we understand this to be a specific city. This is meaningful because when we see all these things unfolding, we have not seen them yet. When we see, for example, that the Antichrist is building the temple, and Saint Cyril of Jerusalem says, which temple? Which temple will the Antichrist enter? This one here? The one we're using now to hold our catechisms? The Church of the Resurrection? Never, Saint Cyril says, never. The Antichrist in the temple of God? Never. But which temple? The temple of Solomon, which is destroyed, and the Antichrist will rebuild the temple, but the temple of Solomon. And of course, this will not be built in another city, but there in Jerusalem. So when we see all these things will help us to understand the signs of the times. These are crucial developments. So the second point is that this great city is characterized as Sodom and Egypt. Initially, why is it called the great city? Due to the great name of this city, and not because it is a large area. Area-wise, Jerusalem is not a very large city, but it has a great name, just like Athens. Athens at this point, it may only have 3-4 million people living around Attica Valley. Let's say that at this point is a great city, but it is not so great because of the population, but it is a great city because of its name, Athens, the great city of ancient Greece. And here we have another great city, the city of Jerusalem. So Athens, the city of wisdom, and the other city, Jerusalem, the city out of which came the Christ, the Lord of heaven and earth, the city that gave birth to Christianity. So it is a great city because of the great events that took place in it. But why is Jerusalem described here as Sodom and Egypt? My friends, the prophets use these names for Jerusalem. In Jeremiah, for instance, 23:14, we read, and all of them became like Sodom, who? The Israelites. And those that reside in her became as Gomorrah, meaning inside Jerusalem. So the prophets describe Jerusalem as Sodom and Gomorrah. And when the Holy Evangelist describes it as Sodom, spiritually or allegorically, he means Jerusalem and not another city. A third point, we have the overt observation, the statement of the Holy Writer that they, the two prophets, they will be put to death in the same city where their Lord was crucified. It is a well-known fact that the Lord was crucified in Jerusalem. All these factors show that the great city here is Jerusalem. But let's listen to some useful thoughts on these observations. The city will be Jerusalem because according to the most wise observation of Saint Andrew of Caesarea, the Antichrist will seek to settle in this city in order to show that he is the awaited Messiah. Furthermore, the spiritual state of the city at that time will be like Sodom and Egypt. Why like Sodom? Simply because there will be much sin, very much sin. Why like Egypt? And this metaphorically, because Egypt had tortured the Israelites back then when they stayed in Egypt for 430 years. They made them suffer greatly. They forced them to make bricks, building blocks, to work in hard labor, to build constantly, to break them, to keep them weak, because they were threatened by them. At some point, they began to throw their male children inside the Nile River, and many other things. As Israel suffered from the Egyptians, this is how the new Israel, the church, will suffer from the old Israel, from Jerusalem. That's why it is described as Egypt. You want proof? Zionism, this Hebraic organization, is spread all over the earth, especially targeting the Christians. Today undercover, tomorrow openly, and in the future, it will turn against the church openly. This is why Jerusalem is described as Egypt. The protocols of the wise of Zion may initially seem fictional, my friends. Someone would say, no, this can't be serious. This is not serious literature. Yes, my friends, it is worth reading them. And if we read them carefully, we will see that all these plans are coming to fruition one by one. This publication, which sold in almost all our Orthodox bookstores, at least here in Greece, contains a long catalog describing various methods to corrupt the nations, to destroy and corrupt and paralyze the nations. When a television programming does nothing but that, when the quality of entertainment, the state of our politics, economy, education, read and see how all these things have been instituted and infected by these masterminds. They have accomplished this for the most part. The goal is to beat the nations like a fisherman beats an octopus on the concrete, on the rock, to make it soft, to paralyze the nations. And then the Antichrist will come and proclaim, I'm here to save you. I will save you. Since the nations, after all these years of propaganda, they will not be able to react at all. And in their despair, they will welcome the idea of a one world governor. And in order to make the nations kneel to this degree, the Zionist agenda will have done its work quite well. I repeat again, this is the reason why Jerusalem is described as Sodom and Egypt. Sodom, to corrupt and pervert the world, and to maintain this corrupt lifestyle. Egypt, to have holding power, to maintain this agenda. If someone pays a little attention here, he will see the letter of this text to spell out this reality. And we continue now. Then those from the peoples, tribes, tongues, and nations will see their dead bodies 3.5 days, and they will not allow their corpses to be put into graves. So the leaders of the city, the Antichrist, will not allow the bodies of the prophets to be buried in a grave. The expression peoples, tribes, tongues, and nations is favored by the prophet. He uses this a number of times, aiming to show that this is a universal event. In other words, this is not a local subject, something that we discussed before in the question and answer period. I told you that the book of the Revelation is a universal book and not a local one. And they will see. They will watch. Who sees? All people, all tribes and tongues and nations. People see this on a global scale. All the people of earth. How do they see? How can they see? This was inconceivable for centuries. Now it's very conceivable. the easiest thing to understand, everyone can see this. They will see their dead bodies on television. This phrase, this verse, was inconceivable a few years back, vague, and it could be interpreted in a number of ways. But here we see the value of the great advice of St. Andrew of Caesarea. Everything that begins to unfold, when it comes to fruition, then it will be understood. This point is now reality. The technology is now available. How can all the tongues, tribes, and nations of people and listen, not read about it in the newspapers? The text says to watch, to see, to continually see this event for 3.5 days. They will be seeing the corpses of the prophets for 3.5 days in the center of Jerusalem. They will be seeing this with their own eyes. But how, someone could think 100 years ago? The earth is very large. This is not possible. We can see a couple miles away, and this with binoculars. But now, with satellites and television sets, we have made the earth ever so small, so people will be watching through television. But we must add that this also expresses the feelings of the people of the world. For example, today, my friends, when we have a very important soccer game like the World Cup, this is extremely popular and of great interest. Tell me, wouldn't most people be glued to their TV set? Of course. Likewise here, the fact that all people will be glued to their TV sets and they will be seeing this event expresses the attitude of the spectators who will be eager to witness the preview of the murder of these two prophets, but also the exposition of their corpses in the city of Jerusalem. This display of their unburied bodies will remain so for 3.5 days, corresponding to the witness of the two prophets, which lasted 3.5 years. 3.5 years was the time of their witness, and 3.5 days will be the display of their bodies in the city of Jerusalem. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them, make merry, and send gifts to one another, because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. What malicious joy! What depth of passion of evil! Through TV, as we said, they will see and rejoice and make merry. Why do you think? Because they got rid of the tormenting sermons of the prophets. So the sermon torments the conscience of people. Does the piercing sermon torment the conscience? Why should this bother an atheist? There's no reason for an unbeliever to feel reproached. Since the unbelievers and the atheists are beyond reproach, then why are they tormented? Especially since they don't believe in hell. The atheists are not tormented, and yet they are the ones who initiate persecutions against the Christians. Why is this? Simply because there is no absolute atheist. There is no absolute atheist. I repeat, man was fashioned to believe. God made us for himself. This is in relation to the image of God in all of us. This cannot be uprooted by anyone. This is inside our nature, inside our fiber. So the person who claims he's an atheist, in reality, inside him, in his subconscious, he maintains a certain fear. And when he sees that, he distances that fear, he rejoices, and he exercises this persecution precisely to be liberated from this fear. This is the psychology of the atheist man or woman. So this is a very interesting development that the citizens of the earth will be exchanging gifts among them from their joy and relief. Something similar also happens with us. When we have a joyous feast and we have some special food, we like to send some to our neighbors, our close friends, and they also share with us. They reciprocate as an expression of this joy. However, this was already practiced by the Jews from the time of the Babylonian exile, and we run into this in the book of Esther. Mordecai instituted this feast day, and along the other activities, he also had exchange of meals or gifts.